Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments today, and that's probably a good thing because we have a lot to discuss. Now, last time, we began our discussion of George and Martha Washington and their unique roles as America's first president and first lady. Now, if we really study what they accomplished, we can see that they laid a foundation for building a unique federal government and the culture of the presidency. And there isn't any other nation in the world like the United States. And it's so important that we get this. So for the next several programs, I do want to continue our discussion of the vision of both George and Martha Washington, because she had a big part in it all, and the vision that they had for the American government and also the culture of the presidency. Now, I feel this is so important because so many of America's government leaders today, they actually hold a different vision for America's government structure and even for the office of the presidency. And I think a lot of true blue and true-blooded Americans are a little tired of what the media is doing to the office of the president. Now, really, Americans, we all need to take warning. What some people's new vision of America is really leading to America's destruction. And hopefully these programs will help all of you recapture, let's say, George and Martha's vision of America. Now, to help me do this today, I have called the 60-plus panel back into session. And so my sweet wife is back with me in the studio today. So welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you.
And I know you've done a lot of reading, but I'm going to start. Hopefully I won't be a hog over the radio time, as they might say. But one of the things that we do know, and we were discussing last time, and you can chime in on this part. The rest is up to me. So we know after the Revolutionary War that George Washington really did not want to stay involved as a leader of the army or anything. He wanted to get back to Mount Vernon. And remember, audience out there, that his heart was really in farming. His heart was being a landed gentry. His heart was, you know, raising animals to eat, and also he loved horseback riding and things like that. But the one thing that we know from reading Johnson is that he could not get America's future out of his mind. And so I really think that we need to talk about getting back to maybe Johnson for a little bit. And I do want to just read some things here. And it is really quite, quite interesting. Here's what Johnson has to say on page 79. And this is just after the Revolutionary War. Here's what Johnson has to say. He says, back in Mount Vernon, Washington, now 52, took stock of his personal estate and the state of the nation. His farm and lands were in many cases run down, and after his eight-year absence, remember the Revolutionary War did take 8 years, says their scattered nature made his personal supervision difficult. Not for the first time, he reflected that America's first problem was the tyranny of distance. Now, that's a unique expression, and essentially what Johnson means there is that actually, after the Revolutionary War, the nation was actually beginning to form. And remember, that there were the 13 colonies, but the idea of a federal government was really kind of new for the colonies. Now, Washington knew that part of the problem in, let's say, uniting into the government was the distance between all the states. And essentially what Johnson means by that is that the communications were difficult. Traveling within the colonies were difficult. There weren't enough good roads. There weren't enough good, let's say, transportation systems. Now, here's what Johnson goes on to say. He says, Washington might be called the first secular American. Secular because of some of the preachers of the Great Awakening at the time of his childhood had visited all the colonies. Indeed, it was their ignition of a common religion flame that first gave the 13 territories a sense of nationhood. But religious arousal was the prelude to political and military arousal. Now, the thing is, what we have to understand is that there was some unification, but still, the idea of a federal government, overseeing the state government, still was very new in their thinking. And also the need for a military. I mean, if you look back at the Revolutionary War, a lot of them were just normal people that had joined the militias, and they really did not have an organized army that, say, that was, trained. They didn't have the arms. They didn't have the uniforms. And so all of those things were going to become very important now that the United States or the 13 colonies were going to form into the United States. Now, one thing that I think Johnson brings out is that Washington actually had traveled wider in the colonies than any other preacher. And so he saw things differently than even some of the other founders. Now, Johnson goes on to say he knew much of the frontier. Indeed, in 1758 through 69, he had defended 700 miles of it with only 500 men. He was always on the move, an intense but practical curiosity being one of his strongest characteristics. When he attended the first Continental Congress in Philadelphia in 1774, he had visited more of America than any other delegate had. The great majority were outside their own homeland for the first time. So if you can imagine that, he had been in more states or more colonies than anybody else at that first Continental Congress. Now, Johnson goes on to say, he fought the war over 9 of the 13 states and got to know large parts of the country with painful intimacy, but also with a glowing regard for their potential. And that's the point we need to see is that Washington has such a mind that he could see potential in things. He could walk through these 9 colonies, and he could see incredible potential. Johnson continues, he saw America increasingly in unitary terms, and this vision was strengthened by further travels both before the Constitutional Convention and during his presidency when he made 2 major sweeps through the country, north and south. And so we'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. But one of the things that Washington knew is he knew that the land, that just having the amount of land that the colonies had, there was such incredible potential. But somehow it needed to be tied together better. And, of course, it needed federal government, but also, from his standpoint, he knew it needed these transportation systems. Johnson goes on to say, his diaries show what chiefly interested him. It was the impact of distance on the economy, social life, and opportunity. Any steps to speed up travel were central to the country's future. He noted that stagecoaches ran 3 times a week from Norfolk, Virginia, up to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. But just to get from Richmond to Boston by stage might take 12 days. And so if you get a picture of the geography, what Washington noticed that, on the coastline, there was more transportation than the further inland that you got. And if America was really going to grow, they were going to have to grow their economy. They were going to have to begin to rely on themselves. Their independence from Britain was going to demand that they have these transportation systems and communication systems, and it was important for the social life as well. Johnson also says there was 1 good wagon road into the interior, but south of Virginia, roads, stages, and tracks were so bad that people preferred to travel by sea, a sure sign of a primitive transport economy. So here, America had all this potential, but it was still primitive, and many areas were primitive. But Washington saw the need that had to change. Now, here's also what Johnson has to say. And I do think that even because of my travel in Britain, I can see where America was so different. He said, America, following in Britain's footsteps, but vastly improving on her record, has made fast, extensive, cheap, safe, and reliable travel the essence of her civic craftsmanship. And when you travel, let's say you travel in Britain, a lot of the highways and the roads are still very small. And, you know, it's not easy sometimes to get around. And especially when you get into Ireland, I mean, I know I was warned. I said I wanted to drive in Ireland, and I was warned by the insurance company and by the car company, you don't know what you're even asking for. And then when I got there, I realized, wow, they were right. You know, I mean, here you have these tiny roads, and you have to fight. You have to fight for your lane. I remember we were traveling in the country area of Ireland, and they said, don't run into the hedges because there are block walls behind them. You know, it's not just a hedge. And so we were on this road, and here this tour bus came by, and we had to move over, and there was not very much distance. There was very little shoulder to move onto. And then when we got to our destination, my trunk was full of gladiolas that I had taken out of someone's garden with the car. So I know what Johnson is saying here. He says, Washington was the pioneer. In other words, he was the pioneer of the road systems that we enjoy in this country. Johnson continues, he realized early that the tyranny of distance could be reduced by intelligent use of her tremendous rivers, having canoed some of them the fiercest himself. As early as 1769, he tried to promote the use of lock canals to improve natural waterways like the Potomac and the Ohio. The canal, linked to improved post roads, was the dynamic of the revolution in transport of the 18th century, just as steam was for the 19th, and the internal combustion engine in cars and in aircraft was for the 20th. Washington's diaries show that as soon as the war was over, he turned again to canals. In September 1784, he traveled across the Alleghenies, partly to inspect his western lands, but also to plan canal routes and roads to link Ohio, tributaries to the Potomac. He covered 680 miles, often sleeping in the open. His training as a surveyor gave him valuable insights into viable schemes. In May 1785, he convened and presided at a meeting at Mount Vernon with commissioners from Virginia and Maryland to resolve disputes about making the maximum use of common waterways. So what George Washington probably did not realize at the time, he was still, even though he didn't want leadership, he was actually becoming a great leader. And he saw what America needed. And America needed a transportation system. America needed much more communication. And so he was already organizing like these mini conventions to get these roads and get the canals built. And so it really just led right into, you know, him doing the being a part of the first Continental Convention or the Constitutional Convention. And so here's actually what Thomas Jefferson wrote about him at this time. And Johnson gives us this on page 82. It says, the earnestness with which he expressed the undertaking is hardly to be described and shows that a mind like his, capable of great views and which has long been occupied them, cannot bear a vacancy. And surely he could not have chosen an occupation more worthy of succeeding to that of establishing the political rights of his country than the patronage of works for the extensive and lasting improvement of its natural advantages, works which will double the value of half the lands within the Commonwealth, will extend its commerce, and link its interests with those of the Western states. So here, even Thomas Jefferson realized early on that his thinking about what America needed, you know, other people were not thinking this way. And, you know, Washington was unique in that. But he was really laying the groundwork to become the nation's first president. I mean, it just made sense. He had such a view of things. Now, one other thing I want to just mention before, we go on, is that he really saw the need for rapid development. It wasn't just, okay, let's just take our time and do this over the next 100 years. He wanted to get it done right away because he could see that America or the colonies would fall apart if they didn't have federal government, if they didn't have, some strong leadership over them. Now, I think it's also interesting that Johnson makes a point here that also at this time when he was thinking about the roads and the canals, and I'll just let you read it on your own, but on page 83, he says that he really wanted to end slavery. And he still had slaves, but most of them he was taking care of. They weren't even working. But here's what he put in his journal and said, "It is," he wrote, "among my first wishes to see some plan adopted by which slavery in this country may be abolished by slow, sure, and imperceptible degrees. Its degradation and persistence were only one of his worries. His return from the war and his enlarged grasp of American potential, he had been depressed by the weakness and inertia of Congress and its inability to offer leadership given its feeble powers." And so that's where Washington realized the need for a new constitution, not just the Articles of Confederation, but also the need for a federal government. And so it really is, it's really something that we should be able to see about George Washington and not look at him as some privileged white guy. Now, here's how Johnson concludes this little section on George Washington. And the reason I'm emphasizing this so much is, again, I want to come back to the point that he was really being prepared to be president. Now, here's what Johnson has to say. This is page 89. It says, "The American Constitution was the work of an oligarchy of able men, the founding fathers. But there is a case for arguing that the most influential of them all was Washington, not by his voice, but by his public silence, his presence, and his record of Republican virtue and decisive action speaking louder than words." And so that really tells us, something about his character. Okay, now let's go back to Martha, and we'll go back to Patricia Brady's book. It's titled Martha Washington, An American Life. And I really do highly recommend you get this book and read it. And, if we go back to the presidency, and of course, we kind of skipped a little bit forward, and now we're coming back again. But they really had a lot of pressure on them. Martha was used to Mount Vernon. She was used to how exciting it was there. And then she had to move into entertaining in a much different way. And we've already talked about it in a former program. But one thing that was really upsetting to Martha was George did get sick several times in his first term as president. And, of course, the first time he got this huge carbuncle, on the back of his leg. And maybe you want to talk about some of that, dear. So,
yes, it's Patricia Brady says in her book that only 3 weeks after her arrival, this is Martha's arrival, there in New York as the president's first lady, only 3 weeks after her arrival, George began complaining of fever and pain. A large carbuncle, a hard solid mass, had appeared on his left thigh, and it grew larger and more painful every day. His doctors diagnosed anthrax, presumably of the cutaneous variety, and no anesthesia was available. So they actually had to remove it without anesthesia. And it says George's phenomenal strength brought him through it, but afterwards he groaned with pain, complaining that any noise hurt his head. And, yes.
Yeah, I think it's really kind of interesting there. What she says there is that because they had no anesthesia, they still had to cut this carbuncle out. And the doctor kept saying, cut deeper, cut deeper. And so essentially, if you read this whole section, by the way, all of our listeners, it almost seems like it it really incapacitated him. He could hardly walk after this because they had to cut so deep into his leg. And so I know it's just kind of fascinating what she says there. You can go ahead and continue. I think there's a quote you wanted to read there at the top of page 166. You know,
yes, so. Well, also, he complained that because afterwards he was weakened and any noise hurt his head so much that they worked hard to keep the traffic from making noise passing in front of the house. And so they actually roped off the streets, and then they spread the sidewalks with straw to muffle the footsteps of passerbys. And so it just shows that it really affected a lot of things. And he was really incapacitated for a while. It says Martha was terribly shaken by her husband's condition. The doctors thought he might die, and his convalescence took the rest of the summer. So that's quite a long time. He spent 6 weeks being confined to a lying posture on one side. Although George returned to work, the incision was still draining in September, as the wound given by the incision is not yet closed. Acquaintances continued to call on Martha regularly that summer to inquire after the president's health. Without his leadership, it was feared that the nation might splinter into small, weak confederations. Yeah. So it was kind of dangerous.
Yeah. So the thing is, with this whole idea of them taking over the presidency, we have to remember that it was a great personal sacrifice to them. I mean, it was not easy. And then, he had suffered ill health before. I think he had smallpox, and as a young soldier and things like that. So it just seems like that at that time, it was such a dangerous time to live. I mean, they diagnosed the carbuncle as anthrax, but was it really anthrax? And then they cut into his leg, and it took him, how many months almost to recover. And so I think if we need medical help today, at least I think we probably could be a little more confident in it than it was we would be at that time. So I just wanted to kind of go over this again. I just wanted to read page 166. I think this is interesting. During this time that he was convalescing, they had this. Of course, they had the regal presidential carriage, and they even had to alter it so that he could actually get into this carriage because of this horrible thing they did to him and to take this carbuncle out. Brady says, during George's convalescence, the carriage was altered by putting in some sort of bed so that he could lie on his side and be driven about the city. It took four attendants to get him comfortably arranged in the coach. Martha rode with him on these expeditions, doubtless entertaining him with conversation. But it really did affect even what he could do as president. His age really, really was a problem. And again, I still think he had enough vitality and health to continue going. But still, it was really, really difficult. Page 176, I thought, in Brady is really interesting. And it talks about this. We just read this earlier in Johnson that George was so concerned about making sure America got started on the right footing that he decided to make two tours of all the colonies, and he started going north first, because he was from the South, and he believed that he did not want people to think that if he went south first, that he would just have the southern states in mind or the southern states' concerns in mind. So he went north first. But he really left her alone in New York. And she was not happy about that. And actually, it says that she may have even suffered a little depression. Here's what Brady says in here. It says, George came back in a good mood, buoyed by his reception on the tour and the generally positive attitude he observed among the people. Despite certain disappointments and disagreements with other leaders, the new government was up and running, and most important federal positions filled, courts in place, many precedents set, some taxes collected. But better than anyone, Martha understood how unwillingly her husband had become president and how he dreaded being thought self-interested. She observed of his reaction to the tour. "I am persuaded," she writes, "that he has experienced nothing to make him repent of his having acted from what he conceived to be alone, a sense of indispensable duty." So, but of course, once he was home and happy, Martha really overcame her depression. She was still debating in herself about whether they should have done this. And again, she believed they were growing old. They both had become white-haired. They both had become a little chubby, I guess. And so, you know, they were getting concerned. But also, she just missed her farm and her family life. And so I do think that's an interesting time. Well, that's all we have time for today's program. But next time, we'll continue our discussion of the foundational work of George and Martha Washington. Remember, our third and final book in this series is Hero, the Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can also find a used copy of the book at ABEbooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to JBL at PCOG.org. You can also follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.